shame filter, I use they, he, she pronouns, and I'm the executive director of the LGBT Bar Association and Foundation of Greater New York. This is the March 2024 Law Notes episode of the podcast, and I'm excited to be in conversation with Professor Emeritus Art Leonard, chief editor and writer of Legal's LGBTQ Law Notes, to bring you some critical updates on cases happening around the country. Law Notes is the most comprehensive monthly publication covering the latest legal developments both in the United States and abroad affecting LGBTQ plus people. I want to remind our listeners that the views expressed on our podcast are not an appropriate substitute for legal advice and may or may not reflect the views of the Bar Association and or its foundation. Professor Leonard, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Shane.
So we're starting off with one of our lead stories today with a topic that we don't always get as much time to discuss as I would like, but thinking about jury selection.
Yes, we have a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to deny cert in an important case involving whether people who are willing to state openly during voir dire that they consider homosexuality to be a sin should be sitting as jurors on cases where the plaintiff is a gay or lesbian person suing for discrimination because of their sexual orientation. Very interesting question. So this came up in Missouri, and the case involved a corrections officer for the Missouri Department of Corrections, a lesbian named Jean Finney, and she was suing the department in state court, claiming that she had been subjected to discrimination because of her sexual orientation. And during voir dire, the plaintiff's lawyer, in questioning the potential jurors, asked a question that provoked the answers that got these people excluded from the jury. How many of you went to a religious organization growing up where it was taught that people that are homosexuals shouldn't have the same rights as everyone else because it was a sin with what they did? And so they asked for a show of hands, and several jurors, potential jurors, raised their hands, and the lawyer then asked them to explain their views, after which the lawyer asked that they be excused from the jury pool for cause. That is, that they wouldn't have to use up preemptive challenges for them, that they would be excused for cause. Three of the potential jurors stated that homosexuality is a sin, but all three of them explained that it was one of many sins. One of them said, you still have to love those people, and you still have to treat them right in society. You don't have the right to judge them. Therefore, I think I could be a fair juror. Everybody sins. All of us here do. So that sin isn't any more or worse than any other. So that was one of them. Another potential juror, after making similar remarks, was specifically asked by the attorney for the defendant, the Department of Corrections, if that would, quote, impact your ability to be a fair and impartial juror in this case. And this potential juror said, absolutely not. That has really nothing to do with, in a negative way, with whatever this case is going to be about. And another potential juror said, I firmly stand on the word of God and what the word of God says. And much like what this other man said, a sin is a sin. And thank goodness they're all the same. But, you know, none of us can be perfect. And so I'm here because it's an honor to sit in here and to perhaps be a part of, you know, a civic duty. But yes, homosexuality, according to the Bible, is a sin. So is gossiping. So is lying. So is, I mean, we could go on and on. Well, the trial judge decided to exclude all three of these potential jurors for cause. And the state did not object at that time. The defendant did not object formally at that time. The case went to the jury, and the jury ruled in favor of Ms. Finney, the plaintiff, awarding her $175,000 in non-economic damages and $100,000 in punitive damages. The verdict, of course, was against the Department of Corrections because this was brought under employment discrimination law. It wasn't brought against the, for example, the people who were subjecting her to a hostile environment and so forth. So it's against the state, basically. And the court ordered that the defendant pay substantial attorney's fees to the three lawyers who had represented Ms. Finney at trial, which totaled substantially more than the damages. In fact, the state was on the hook for more than $700,000. Not too surprising that they tried to figure out a way to appeal. And they appealed, the court's final judgment, and they claimed that excluding the, quote, religious jurors violated the jurors' equal protection rights under the 14th Amendment to the federal constitution and their religious freedom rights under the Missouri constitution. So the verdict should be vacated and a new trial should be held. The Missouri Court of Appeals rejected that appeal. They affirmed the full amount of damages. They said that the potential jurors were not excluded because they were religious Christians, but rather because of their opinions on an issue that would be part of the case. And also the court pointed out because the defense had not objected to their removal during the jury selection process, the court would uphold the trial court's decision to exclude them because it did not constitute, quote, plain error. State sought to appeal to the Missouri Supreme Court, which rejected the appeal, didn't even hear it on the merits. Evidently, it has control of its docket and it didn't have to take the appeal if it didn't want to. So then they appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And as usual, the court doesn't officially explain why they've denied the cert petition. This was denied in February 20th. But sometimes members of the court file separate statements explaining how they voted. And this was our old friend, Justice Samuel Alito, who climbed onto his hobby horse about the dangers of the Obergefell opinion, as if that's relevant. Well, it's relevant to him. He said, in this case, the court below reasoned that a person who still holds traditional religious views on questions of sexual morality is presumptively unfit to serve on a jury in a case involving a party who is a lesbian. That holding exemplifies the danger I anticipated in Obergefell, namely that Americans who do not hide their adherence to traditional religious beliefs about homosexual conduct will be, quote, labeled as bigots and treated as such, unquote, by the government. The opinion of the court in that case made it clear the decision should not be used in that way, but I am afraid that this admonition is not being heeded by our society. And Alito continues to raise objections to Obergefell at every opportunity, and taken together with Justice Thomas's call in the Dobbs case for reconsideration of Obergefell by the court based on Alito's opinion in Dobbs, that's the abortion case, really gutting the law of substantive due process as it has been practiced by the Supreme Court up to now. So this is why people remain very concerned about the possibility that the court will actually get its hands on a case involving whether Obergefell should be overruled. But for now, they have ducked the issue. And of course, that wasn't the central issue in this case. But it's a very important point. Do people hold, quote, traditional or orthodox religious views about homosexuality, are they presumed to be unqualified to serve on a jury in which the plaintiff is gay? And the issue in the case is whether they were discriminated because they were gay. I mean, the logic of the trial court and of the plaintiff's lawyers seem pretty clear here, that if someone is going in as a juror in a trial and is regarding the plaintiff as a sinner and a violation of their moral code, isn't there a chance that certainly that the plaintiff will perceive that she hasn't gotten a fair trial if she loses before that jury? So there is certainly an argument to be made. And the Missouri Court of Appeals made the argument. They said that these people had an opinion with respect to an issue in the case, and therefore it was appropriate to excuse them from jury duty.
It's certainly an appropriate point to jump in and either inform or remind our listeners that our friends at the LGBTQ Plus Bar Association, the National LGBTQ Bar Association, have put together a lot of resources about the issue of jury access, and we'll be sure to share a link to that with this month's program as well. Our next case that we're checking in on today is returning to a situation in Maine that we've discussed during prior podcasts. Tell us a little bit more about what's happening with access to education in Maine.
Okay, Maine. And here's the issue in Maine. Maine, as we've discussed before, has areas of the state that are rather thinly populated. to the extent that particular educational local school administrative units, as they call school districts in Maine, don't have enough students of secondary school age to support the running of a public high school in that unit or a public middle school. And so the legislature has set up a program under which they will subsidize the cost of sending them to a public school outside the school district or a private school in the school district. Only private schools that are approved, though, for this purpose. Now, as originally passed, the law said that religious schools could not be included in this, that the state was not going to subsidize tuition for students to go to religious schools. That case went to the Supreme Court, challenged by a religious school, and the Supreme Court held that that violated the equal protection rights of the students and the school. And this is part of the sort of free exercise clause on steroids that we've seen in the Supreme Court now, and basically the gutting of the Establishment Clause. And under traditional Establishment Clause jurisprudence for a long period of time, ever since the First Amendment was incorporated into the Due Process Clause and applied to the states early in the 20th century, it's been pretty clear that taxpayers are not to be called upon in this country to finance religious education, in general speaking. But the Supreme Court has really abandoned that view now, and they say if the state sets up a program that assists people in sending their children to private schools, they can't categorically exclude all religious schools from that. That would be discriminating against religion. And discriminating against religion has become like one of the number one sins identified by the Supreme Court under the First Amendment in recent cases. So that case, Carson versus Macon, was decided in 2022. While that case was pending, the legislature amended the law to remove the categorical exclusion of religious schools from being able to participate in the tuition reimbursement program. However, at the same time, they amended the state's human rights law to add gender identity to prohibited grounds of discrimination. Sexual orientation was already in there from prior amendments. And they modified a provision that had been added to the human rights law when sexual orientation was added, that said that the sexual orientation discrimination ban would not apply to religious schools. Well, they modified that as well when they were making these modifications in anticipation of the Carson versus Macon decision. They said that the exemption would extend only, the exemption from complying with the non-discrimination law would extend only to a religious school, quote, that does not receive public funding. Which means a religious school that's going to discriminate against students or staff or teachers on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity can't participate in the reimbursement program. Now, is that a categorical exclusion of all religious schools? No, because not all religions are homophobic, because there are religions in this country that are pro-gay. In fact, various Protestant denominations, various Jewish denominations are strongly pro-gay, and in fact have openly gay ministers, openly gay rabbis, and gay congregations that are affiliated with the movements. So this wouldn't be a categorical exclusion of all religious schools, but it would certainly be an exclusion of the religious schools who had brought the Carson versus Macon case. And so they went back to court and they said this was a poison pill that was put in there, because the human rights law has an exemption for religious schools, but now they've added, but not if they receive public money. And receiving public money for religious schools, well, the only way religious schools are going to receive public money is under the tuition reimbursement program, because they are no longer categorically excluded from that program. And that is, of course, public money. That's taxpayer money. So the schools that are run by the plaintiff here, and the plaintiff is a religious body that has several schools that could potentially be receiving students from around the state under the tuition reimbursement program, they're going to be disqualified as long as they refuse to comply with the law. Now, at this point, it's all sort of hypothetical, but what they wanted was a declaratory judgment that this violated their rights. Now, District Judge John A. Woodcock Jr. refused to issue the preliminary injunction. He had concluded that the plaintiff was unlikely to succeed on the merits of his claim, so would not be entitled to preliminary relief. He said, the educational anti-discrimination provisions do not violate the Free Exercise Clause because they are neutral, generally applicable, and rationally related to a legitimate government interest. The legitimate government interest was banning discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity in various things, including education. That's a legitimate state interest. And under Employment Division versus Smith, a case that has been battered and accepted to and all kinds of things, and there's concern that the Supreme Court may finally abandon it. But under that, as long as a state has a rational basis for a law that incidentally burdens free exercise of religion, but doesn't target religion and is generally applicable, the state needs only a rational basis. And the rational basis is their policy against discrimination. But he also acknowledged in this opinion, he said, this case presents novel constitutional questions in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision in Carson versus Macon. So he framed his opinion, quote, as a prelude to a challenge to the Court of Appeals for the First Circuit for a more authoritative ruling. So the judge wrote this with full expectation that the denial of preliminary injunction will be appealed. But in the meantime, the magistrate judge, to whom supervision of pretrial activity was delegated, has issued a schedule for discovery and for summary judgment motions with an eye to trial, if needed, in October of 2024. But in the meantime, it's generally expected that there will be an appeal to the First Circuit. And incidentally, Judge Woodcock was appointed by President George W. Bush, who refused the preliminary injunction here. So another chapter in the case of the Maine Tuition Reimbursement Program and religious schools.
Another chapter indeed, and that book is far from over. Thank you for bringing us up to speed on that, and I look forward to continuing to discuss that case with you throughout the year.
Sure, there's probably going to be more action.
Our next case completely changes the direction of the conversation. Our next case, we're thinking through for insurance purposes, what does it mean to be infertile? That might sound like an obvious question at first, but one that disproportionately impacts LGBTQ plus communities. So take us through that struggle.
Okay, and this case is Burton versus Aetna Incorporated, Aetna the insurance company, of course. And Aetna writes group in health insurance policies that it sells to employers and organizations and others who are doing group insurance plans for their employees or their members or whatever. The plan sponsor in this case was an entity called Encore, which is not otherwise identified in the court's opinion. This is an opinion by the U.S. District Court in the Northern District of California. It's in San Francisco. Group health insurance policy sold to Encore that Aetna, of course, drafted and administered the policy, but they negotiate with the entity buying the policy over its terms. And in this policy, coverage for donor insemination procedures, that is assisted reproductive technology, or ART as it's sometimes referred to, turns on whether the covered individual is infertile within the meaning of the policy. That is the position of the insurance company as contracted by the sponsor of the plan is that our health insurance is for people who are sick, or, you know, have an illness, have some kind of medical problem due to accidents, injuries, whatever. That's what it covers. And we consider infertility to be a medical condition. And so we will cover assisted reproductive technology if it's necessary for an individual or a couple to have a child. But you have to prove that you're infertile. Now, the plaintiff in this case, Mara Burton, is a lesbian with a same-sex spouse who wishes to become pregnant through donor insemination because they want to have a child together. And the only way they can do it is to get somebody's sperm in there. We still haven't figured out how to generate a child without the participation of a donor. And assisted reproductive technology means not a donor to have sex, a donor to donate sperm that is then introduced into the member of the couple who is going to bear the child. Aetna denied her application for coverage for the donor insemination procedure under its infertility policy. And the suit is brought under Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex by insurers. And within the Ninth Circuit, in this case arose in California, so it's in the Ninth Circuit, Ninth Circuit now recognizes that the Bostock decision, saying that discrimination because of sexual orientation or gender identity is a form of sex discrimination, is applicable under the Affordable Care Act and under other statutes banning discrimination because of sex. So Burton claims that the infertility policy discriminates against same-sex couples by making it much more expensive and burdensome to qualify for coverage than it is for heterosexual couples. And here's the reasoning. If you have a heterosexual couple, the policy is that if they engage in unprotected sexual intercourse for a year and the woman doesn't become pregnant, they will consider her infertile for purposes of the policy and authorize coverage for assisted reproductive technology. But if it's not a heterosexual couple, if it's a single woman who wants to become pregnant, or if it's a same-sex couple, such as Ms. Burton and her partner, they have to undergo assisted reproductive technology through 12 monthly cycles. And if the intended birth mother does not become pregnant, then they will be considered infertile and assisted reproductive technology will be made available, or coverage will be made available for it. But first, they have to go through 12 cycles of insemination. What is the likelihood that if they go through 12 cycles of insemination at their own expense, she will become pregnant? Pretty high if you go through 12 cycles. Is it expensive? Yeah. If you go through 12 cycles, if you are involving medical personnel and everything else, it's expensive. And if it's successful, it's not covered because she wasn't infertile, right? And if they go through the 12 cycles and she doesn't become pregnant, maybe she is infertile, but it means assisted reproductive technology will not make it possible for her to become pregnant because she's infertile. So it's sort of interesting. There's a real catch-22 built in here. But she points out that it basically is a way for them to avoid paying for assisted reproductive technology for same-sex couples. And if they want to qualify somehow and to meet their definition of infertile, they have to incur a substantial expense. And the federal district judge in this case, Haywood S. Gilliam Jr., denied the insurance company's motion to dismiss the case. He said, I think they've posed a viable theory here of sexual orientation discrimination in this case. And Aetna also said that, of course, we don't decide what's covered under this plan. We're the administrator and we wrote the policy, but the coverage terms were negotiated with Encore, the entity that bought the policy for its employees or members. And therefore, a necessary party has not been joined as a defendant. We're the only ones who are being sued. And the court said, well, let's look at it this way. Under the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies are covered. And under the Affordable Care Act, an entity that's covered and discriminates on the basis of sex, or in this case, sexual orientation, may be liable for damages, for monetary damages. The plaintiff is not asking us to order Aetna to modify the policy, which Aetna cannot do unilaterally because it's a contract. They'd have to negotiate something with Encore. And if you want to order Encore to do something, you have to join them as a defendant. But they're not asking you to order Encore to do anything. It seems they went out and they got their assisted reproductive technology, and now they want to be reimbursed for the expenses under the insurance policy. And so the issue here is money. And so the court can provide complete relief to them without involving the sponsor, the plan sponsor. They can do it just with insurance. So they're not a necessary party. It would be nice to include them, but they're not a necessary party. And for the relief the plaintiffs are seeking, it's enough to sue the insurance company. So the motion to dismiss was denied, and now it has to go to trial unless it gets settled. And what would make sense for them to do, of course, is to settle it by just paying the money, because the cost of a trial, especially if they lose, is going to be substantial, because if they lose, you're going to have attorney's fees too, which, as we've seen from a prior case we discussed today, might actually outweigh in amount the actual damages, because the trial is likely to involve expert testimony and all kinds of stuff, and discovery and go on. So that's the Burton case. Very interesting opinion. And it's interesting that we're covering issues that we don't usually cover this month.
Contemplating whether to cover the cost of attorney's fees versus the cost of IVF. That's a lose-lose if you ask me.
Yeah. Okay, so our of note is a particular concern to people in New York, to transgender people in New York and their families. If a transgender person in the state of New York goes to court to get an order to change their birth record to reflect the name that they are now using in a part of their transition consistent with their gender identity, and wants that and the court's notation on the new birth certificate of their gender that they now identify with, should they be able to automatically get that record sealed? So it's not a public record that just anyone can demand and can look at. Do they get some sort of confidentiality there? And in this case, we have, it's matter of Cody W., which is a pseudonym. And Cody W. is a minor, a transgender minor. Their parents took them to court in Saratoga County because they're transitioning and time to get the change in the birth certificate and everything else. And Saratoga County Supreme Court Justice James E. Walsh granted their petition, but refused to put the case under seal, which means just anyone can go and can look it up and can see that there was a transition. And they appealed that to the Appellate Division 3rd Department, Saratoga County in the 3rd Department. So this is in Albany. And there's an opinion from February 22, written by Justice Elizabeth A. Gary, a name that may be familiar to people in the LGBTQ legal community, because Judge Gary is Chief Judge of the 3rd Department and is an out lesbian. So it's interesting that she ends up getting to write this case, but it's for a unanimous panel. And she said, look, the Gender Recognition Act passed in the state of New York makes it very clear. It requires that a court, quote, immediately upon commencement of a proceeding under the act, order information contained in any pleadings or papers submitted to the court to be safeguarded and sealed in order to prevent their inadvertent or unauthorized use or disclosure while the matter is pending. And then it goes on to say, upon request of the applicant or sua sponte, that means by the court on its own motion, the court shall order the records of such change of sex designation proceeding to be sealed, to be opened only by order of the court for good cause shown or at the request of the applicant. And the Appellate Division said this language is clear and unambiguous. Sort of, what were you thinking, Justice Walsh? Do you read statutes? But it's important to people to know who are providing these legal services of doing the documentation, getting the official documents to accompany a gender transition procedure, that they've got this statutory thing in their pocket, and to know about it, to get the citations ready, and to ask the judge to seal the record. And if the judge hesitates, you've got an opinion now, a published opinion by the Appellate Division that says, look, this is what the statute says. So important knowledge for people practicing in New York.
Important knowledge and a wonderful victory. as you pointed out, so important for people who are needing that legal assistance when they're seeking the legal component of their transition. So thank you for bringing us such an uplifting of note to end our podcast today.
And of course, Legal has name change clinics, right?
Periodically, we have name change clinics.
Right. So we have people, and they're going to be informed of this. So if people want confidentiality, they're entitled to it. And in fact, the statute encourages the court to just do it sua sponte and not even wait to be asked.
And of course, if people are unable to connect with us through a specific name change clinic, we always offer our flagship drop-in clinic every Tuesday night at the center.
Well, Professor Leonard, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you, as always, to our listeners. I want to remind our listeners and our subscribers out there, of course, that Law Notes is just a sampling of the many wonderful articles that are in the publication each month. This month in particular featured such a wide variety of issues, for better or for worse, that are impacting the LGBTQ+ community. So please remember to check out the publication as well, in case there are stories that you were hoping to hear about that we weren't able to address with today's program. And if you are a faithful listener to the podcast, we thank you for your attention, and please continue to like, share, and find us on your favorite podcast streaming platform.